Bosley, brought to you by Barfoot & Thompson.
On the show today, we're talking leadership and with an expert who's got some great stories to tell. Welcome to Property Matters. Welcome along to another Monday. Thanks for tuning in if you're listening live here on Planet FM, or perhaps you've downloaded one of our podcasts, which you can do from any podcast site. Have a listen. We've got some great past episodes for you to listen to as well. Now, this week, taking a little break from investment, as we also love to chat leadership on the show. And I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Scantlebury from Scantlebury Consulting. Good afternoon, Paul.
Kia ora. How are you, Stephen?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us on a Monday afternoon on this beautiful day in Auckland.
Indeed.
Of course, if you're listening to a podcast and it's raining today, sorry about that. But look, you and I caught up a couple of months ago and sort of got interested and trapped inside some of your stories, which was fantastic. And we're going to talk leadership today, but I want to unpack your journey so far, because you spent over two decades helping leaders move from good to great. I want you to take us back to the beginning. What originally sparked your passion for leadership and team dynamics? And I guess walk us through some of those career highlights that kicked it all off.
Gosh, it feels like you are taking me back quite a long way, Stephen. And I think if I think about where it all started, I think for me, leadership wasn't the first thing that really kind of drove me to this. It was the interest in people.
Okay.
Because when we kind of break it down, leadership really is about understanding others and having a curiosity to not just do the thing that you think is right, but to help and encourage others doing things that will be right for them. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about some of my kind of personal elements of attachment to disability as well, and how that kind of shaped me. But I've always had an interest in people. I've not always been the most academic of people. I have a degree, I've got all this stuff, but I've not always been the most academic of people. And I think what I found was that there's a big difference between being able to understand and engage with people in a topic and being an expert in it. If you can do both things, then you're golden. You can really fly. So early on in my career, I kind of had some experiences where I was doing well in my job. I was in recruiting at the time. I worked for agency recruiting and I worked in-house, and I was doing well. It was very relational based type of work that I was doing. And as happens in so many places, someone who's good at something then gets told, hey, you should start managing people. You should start being a team leader and then being a manager. And I started realizing what I was doing is I was good at recruiting and I was trying to help others be like me. And I was finding friction. I was finding tension in these moments of me going, okay, well, this is how I do it. Maybe you could do something similar. There was a point in my career when I had a guy who was not doing very well in another team. And I was basically past him. And my boss at the time said, Paul, if look after this guy. We're moving across from the other team here. If it doesn't work out, no one's going to judge you. No one's going to blame you. It's not going to be on you. You know, just try and help. And if it doesn't work out, then, you know, we'll find a door for him. And I took that moment as one that was a real personal challenge for me to understand how I could see if this was a skill thing or a will thing. That particular moment with that person, I stopped trying to teach him how to be me. I started off with hey, you can listen to me on a call. You can see how I do it. You can see how I talk to people and what my expectations are. And we went through that a little bit, and I could see him raising a bit of an eyebrow, and I stopped and went, talk to me about what it was that didn't work for you. Tell me why you think all of those things didn't land well, why it didn't work with the manager that you were with the business context. And he gave me so much that highlighted his motivators, how he worked, how he thought. And I started to change my style to dial into what are the things that make you great? Not what were the things that made me great, but what are the things that make you great? And I'll help you with those. And if it doesn't work out, I was a little bit on a win-win. Because if it didn't work out, I wasn't getting reprimanded. I wasn't getting a bad rating off the back of that. That chap turned in the next 6 months to being the highest performer in my team. And it flicked a bit of a switch for me. It flicked the switch that was actually, as a leader, what you need to do, or what you can choose to do, is to focus on the other person and what the other person needs, not on what you think they need or what you want them to do. Yes, there's frameworks and dynamics. If you've got to make X number of placements, you've got to do all those different things. But the how it's done, to some end, doesn't matter. And when the how is connected to that individual's drive, makes a huge difference.
Did that other manager that passed him on to you ever reflect and look back or comment on that?
To be fair, I was lucky because she actually ended up being my boss. Okay. For a period of about a year, and she gave me a huge amount of creds, and
nice.
I give her thanks for that, because she recognised and said, look, I couldn't figure him out. Couldn't figure out why it wasn't working, because he was doing a bunch of the things right, but he was just spending too much time and energy on the wrong things, because he'd taken context of working in agency, he was now working in-house, different environment, he was doing the things that made him really good in agency, and it was just the wrong space. And she was so busy, and she knew this is one of the things she reflected on with me, because we built a really good relationship. She was a good mentor. Would I do all the things that she did? No. But she was a good mentor because she let me not have to do the things. And one of her reflections was that she was just too busy.
Yeah.
Too busy to actually manage him. Too busy to coach him.
So in which case, did the right thing in bringing someone else into the mix.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Over your career span, have you yourself, I guess, learnt from the good, the bad, and the ugly managers out there of leadership, and said, I'll take that little bit, I definitely don't want that. And, does it help shape what you've done?
100%. It's a great question. And I still am, if I'm honest, because I no one is ever done when it comes down to figuring out how we best show up as leaders, and to some end, show up as good human beings. So every engagement and every interaction gives you opportunity to go, oh, that person does that really well, or is really authentic, or is really good at that thing, and could I just take a little bit from that to build myself up more?
Take us back through your career journey a little bit.
Okay. So you may be able to tell from the accent, I am British, and I've had a funky path here to Aotearoa, New Zealand. I'm not going to go all the way back to the first thing I did, although that would be an interesting story for another time, possibly. Kind of my first part of my actual career was in recruiting, and I worked for Michael Page. I was on one of their graduate programs. Whilst at uni, I was a travel agent. I love travel. What a cool industry. Pays terrible. And ended up accidentally falling into recruiting because a good friend of mine had gotten into another recruitment agency and just said, hey, Paul, it's all about people. It's all about understanding others. It's stuff that you might be good at. To be fair, he'd known me since I was like six. He lasted in recruiting for 9 months.
Right.
And does something completely different now. But he knew me well enough to give me good advice. And for many, many years, I was in recruiting. And what I did is that I started in agency and then went in-house in the UK. I kind of built up a recruiting team there, and then the global financial crisis hit. So for those of us who have a few more wrinkles and a little bit more gray in our hair, that was pretty ropey time. And again, a leadership journey for me was having to make all of the team that I'd built and invested so much love in, make them all redundant. And then having to step back to doing the job again, which did two things for me. It made me realize that nothing is permanent. We all have to realize that the interactions we have with a business are those interactions. But they can become meaningful when you choose to do stuff that's important to you. I then left that company. I went on to work for EY, the consultancy firm. I was there for, 13 odd years. And this is where I kind of learned my skills of the trade of being kind of a leadership consultant, because I was very privileged and I consider myself blessed to have worked for a company that had so many smart people who did this for their lives. So that example that I gave you around that employee, I was able to go, because I recruited for the consulting team, and say to the people and culture team, they were people and change teams, actually what they were called at the time, so they went and did people and change consulting. I said, look, I I know you do this stuff somewhere else. I'm learning how to become a good manager, a good leader. Help me. Mm. And one of the partners there took me under her wing a little bit and said, hey, well, there's these things. There's TRACOM social styles. Go do that. There's coaching. Go and try some of that out. And that evolved over my years with EY. So I was in the UK. I then moved to the Middle East. And I covered 16 countries across the Middle East and North Africa. And again, blessed. By the way, my career was never planned. My whole approach to my career is do things you love and see where it takes you.
Yeah, nice.
And in that context, I was taken there to fix a broken team or fix a team that had a bunch of functional challenges. And I, at one point, I'm like, hey, I'm a reasonable leader. I've done this for long enough. It's a big team. But it was very, very cross-cultural. And I realized I didn't have all the tools. So I looked around me and looked at some of the frameworks that we were using with our clients. And I started to learn about and became accredited as a high-performing teams consultant with the foundations of Patrick Lencioni's work. So I worked there for a number of years. I loved being in the Middle East. It's a bizarre, beautiful, multicultural, dysfunctional, just so much of life is there, and it can be really confronting in some ways, but it can also be really so nice to embrace if you are able to find the right parts and you can kind of create your own space that means you don't get sucked into some of the negatives. And then from there, with EY still, there was an opportunity to move to APAC for an APAC role, looking as a kind of center of excellence worker. And that was here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. So we came here actually because my wife had her sister and her best friend from when they were kids both lived here. And we're like, why not? Like, we'd never been to New Zealand. Brilliant. I had been to Australia and bits, this kind of parts of the world. So yeah, then we moved here, and that was 8 or so years ago. And part of that then journey was me actually setting up as a consultant and being a consultant independently. I had been a consultant on the side whilst I was with EY in those other spots because I'd built up the accreditations, and people just asked me to do the work, which was really nice. And there's a disability element to that we might come to as well.
Yeah. Before we do that, I'm curious, you know, you mentioned your roles taking you all over the globe, adapting to different cultures and industries, ranging from startups to tech giants to logistics and even some political parties in your career. How did living and working across the UK, and you mentioned the Middle East, Australia, now New Zealand, how did it change how you view human connection, or did it change?
So yes, it did. It absolutely, it shaped my viewpoints massively. And actually the move to the Middle East was the big one. So in the UK, this was a few years back, as anybody who is listening to this won't be able to see the grey hairs that I have, and I have more than one or two. And when I moved to the Middle East, or before I moved to the Middle East, I was the DEI guy. So you didn't have diversity folks that were embedded in teams. I was like my boss, every time someone said, oh, what are we doing about diversity and recruitment? I got wheeled out because I was the employee resource group, like affinity group leader for people with disabilities. I had a degree in psychology. I had the interest in people. I was involved with that stuff. So, you know, he rolled me out because I could talk to the topic. And then when I went to the Middle East, so I thought, I'm going to the Middle East, I'm like, I understand inclusion, I understand diversity, I understand multicultural environments, because I'd lived and worked in London for many years. And then I realised it was like having the blinkers taken off, because in the Western world, we live in these really almost polite parameters, where, yes, there are multiple cultures, there are multiple different dynamics, but we have some boundaries on each side of that. And then you go to somewhere like the Middle East, and all of a sudden the boundaries on each side are so wide and varied. You have some of the richest of the rich, you have some of the poorest of the poor, you have integration and the cultural melding of everyone from everywhere. So we were in the UAE, and Dubai is known as one of the kind of hubs for many different cultures. And I realized that actually I was from a global standpoint, I was a baby. I had been operating in a with an understanding of diversity and what different cultures meant, but within a certain set of parameters. Then all of a sudden, and I'll the negatives on one side, there was some accepted racism and some real negativities and prejudices that were unchecked. And on the other side, there were all of these people from all of these cultures who were able to blend and get on. And I think, did it shape me? The big thing that I learned was, if you are curious about others, about people from different places and different backgrounds, every time you learn something, you will start to know that you don't know everything. So the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And what it did is it really dialed into my curiosity and allowed me to fail. It allowed me to say, hey, I'm meeting you for the first time and you're from Sri Lanka, and I know a little bit about where you're from, but I've never been there and I don't get it. And if I get it wrong, that's okay, because there are so many variants of it. But be in the conversation, be curious, want to be involved, and it opens people's minds and it opens people's hearts to the conversation, because you're being just curious and empathetic and respectful.
Nice. You talked before about facing life with some disabilities, I guess is probably the best way to say it. And in that, you've chaired employee-led groups worldwide. How has your own lived experience fueled your professional mission to build environments of inclusion and belonging, especially when they're not there, I guess?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny how inclusion can be everywhere without us knowing it and can be not present when we think it should be. So your question was around how kind of my experience with disabilities. So I have two disabilities. I have dyslexia and I have a spinal condition called ankylosing spondylitis. Now, for reference, neither of them, they're both genetic. They are not connected, but the dyslexia means I still can't spell ankylosing spondylitis.
You wouldn't be alone there.
Yeah, well, yeah. K's and Y's and S's in all the wrong places for my brain. But I didn't know that. So I was tottering on through life until kind of my mid-20s. And I love sports. I have played probably badly most sports that you can name out there. I've broken a lot of bones, but I've enjoyed it. I love engaging with the world. I'm out there running. I'm a guy who cycles to work. I do all that kind of stuff. I'm that annoying person. Yes, I'm aware of that. But in those contexts, what I was doing, I felt like part of who I was, my identity, was connected to my ability to be able to engage with the world in a physical way. Then in my mid-20s, I was about 25, I started getting pains in my kind of lower back and my hips. And it started going from me just being a little bit achy in the morning to being in such pain I couldn't move for 5-6 days at a time. And it was debilitating. I was misdiagnosed for about 2 years with sciatica. And sciatica itself is really challenging and very painful, and itself can be extremely hard to manage. During that period of time, I was in some dark places, because the thing that I thought was me, I thought I was the invincible, you know, as we all do in our mid-20s. I know, you still are invincible, of course.
Thank you, Stephen. You can come back.
I can see that. But as we all do, I thought I was invincible. I thought it was that guy. And then all of a sudden to have that just taken away from me in what felt like moments, I got to some dark places. I also was on some medication. They tried some medications when I actually got correctly diagnosed that I reacted badly to. I was hospitalized because of it. All kinds of horrible stuff. What it made me do is it made me have to look again at myself and who I am in the world. It gave me a different depth of empathy for folks who may have lived with similar kind of physical conditions through their whole lives.
And often unseen.
100%.
And that's, you know, kind of still that premise that's out there, you know, disability, but you're not in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that, I guess, that then framed a little bit of how I started to have to be more empathetic, or I have to. No, I chose to. I chose to go, well, I see the world differently now, and I'm having to reform how I see it. And then I was very blessed that when I worked for EY, they had an employee-led resource group, and the leader of that was just a wonderful human being. Just, you know when you meet those people who are just nice, super smart, but very empathetic, very capable, great at his job, and he kind of joined me in on the network, which shortly we end up leading together. Now, this is another way that it changed the way that I view the world. Is part of that, we had a number of different sub-networks, and one of them was a dyslexia network. We had one of the board members of the British Dyslexia Association, and we hosted them every year for their annual conference at EY's offices, which was super. And I was at one of the conferences at one point, and afterwards I'm talking to an occupational psychologist, and I'm like, oh, I really resonate with, they're talking about kind of being more of a visual learner, kind of having challenges with words and kind of all these kind of things. And this, God bless this occupational psychologist, I only ever met her this once, and she just put her hand on my shoulder and said, Paul, it's really interesting what you're saying. I wonder if you should just, maybe go and get tested. And I'm like, what do you mean? It's like, just listen to what you've described. I then went and got tested, and I had dyslexia. And then, see, the first instance was really hard for me. It was really like it broke me, and I had to build back up. This instance, it was like somebody just flicked the light switch on, and I was like, oh, that's the reason that I felt out of place in so many learning environments. That's the reason I was, to be fair, as a kid in the UK, I was physically was the kid who was put in the corner because I was the dunce, right. Which wasn't a nice experience,
no.
But is also one of the reasons that I then developed capability in sports, because you don't have to read and write when you're playing sports well, and people often lift you, and you can travel from a social perspective by doing that. So then this was one of those moments of going, oh, things make sense now. And again, so that creating those environments when people can figure those things out about themselves, and I'm sure there's many people who listen to this now who may be parents, for example, the diagnoses of people who particularly have neurodiverse conditions has really changed. There'll be parents who go, oh, well, my son or daughter has been diagnosed with X, and go, oh, that feels a little bit like me. And that feels, and creative for me in the workplace, creating spaces where people can be allowed to explore that and feel that, you know what, just because you have a different way of thinking or a different way of being doesn't mean that you can't be able to bring all of that and bring your authentic self, really resonated, because I needed people to create that for me in some tough times. I guess maybe it's a little bit of paying it forwards. It also feels quite nice to do it, if I'm honest.
Yeah, fair. You talk about turning a group of individuals who just happen to work in the same space into a highly performing team. What is the difference between a group of co-workers and a truly connected team?
That's an interesting one. And it's an interesting one because a lot of the time we don't think about ourselves and our teams as being that way. You can look at it and go, oh, no, but we're performing really, really well. We get along really, really well. We're all doing our jobs great. We get high performance reviews. The differentiator for me is when you talk to people about their job and you say, hey, what is it that makes your work great? What makes you successful? What makes you want to come back into it? What is the reason that you're a high performer? People who give you two or three things and they're all, I did this, I achieved that target, I made this thing happen. And then people who say, always we have a dial for what we've done, of course, because we are intrinsically that way as human beings. But then the ones who are in teams that are not just individuals working on the same topic are the ones who go, oh, it was great when I helped the team do this, or collectively we did something. And you see those teams go so much further.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally agree. But you run workshops or interactive activation sessions, you call them.
Yep.
Executives are notoriously distracted and busy. I know when I'm in meetings, sometimes you're very aware that they've got 10 things happening in their head at once. How do you get a room full of high-powered leaders to just slow down and actually commit not only to your workshop, to behavioural change?
So for me, it's questions. Yeah. I mean, questions and curious. You'll see the theme that comes across here. Being curious, being empathetic, and being respectful are three characteristics that I think get you a long way in life. With those leaders, I just ask. I have stuff that I can do with them for sure, and I've seen that it works. But if they don't want to be on the journey, they don't want to be on the journey. It's not worth anybody investing that. The way to help them understand that the journey might be worthwhile them going on is to say, "So, what's important to you?" And so often people will say, "Oh, it's results." Cool. What is it? How do you get to those results? You start unpicking the different elements of it, and then you ask, so what's blocking you from achieving those results? What's the most important aspect of your business? Nearly everyone says the people, right? Common answer. When you start digging into why you're not achieving as much as you think you could, people understand that a lot of the time, sometimes it's structural. Sometimes, yes, you need good processes and procedures in place. Well, why don't you have them in place then? Mm. Is there resistance? Why is there resistance? So much of it is down to the human element. It's how we show up and it's how people show up with us. So I get them into the room by saying, I can help you solve. I'm not going to fix your process problem. I'm not going to be able to. I'm not going to tell you how you do your supply chain process improvement. But I am going to tell you how you can get people to want to adapt the change and adopt it. I can help you with how do you get people to feel accountable to the fact that someone else has told them that they need to do a thing for whatever reason. How can I help them feel connected to the outcome and therefore collectively connected to the overall result? And if you want that, cool. I'm here to go on that journey with you, and it's a journey. It's not just one workshop. It's multiples of those because it's behavioural change and it's mindset change.
I love that you refer to questioning, right? That people underestimate in all parts of leadership and facilitation the power of good questioning.
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, actually, and obviously, Stephen, you're saying this because one of your jobs here is good questioning.
Good questions.
And you're doing that very well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I trained in a theatre background, but in an applied theatre setting. And when we were facilitating some very tough conversations around child abuse and family neglect up and down the country in an education setting, everything we did was through gentle questioning. Mm. And it created such a safe space for people to just freely talk because you weren't leading the conversation. You were just giving those things to get it started.
Yeah. Yeah. And Stephen, those are some really hard topics too.
Oh, yeah.
And it's fascinating. I'm not sure, I hope you share this experience, but when you're able to create those spaces for people to be able to share on those hard topics, not because you made them, but because you just opened the door to allow them to feel comfortable to do it, it's super empowering.
It's creating that space. So how does understanding, I guess, our unique social style change the way we handle difficult conversations in the workplace?
See, that's fascinating. I know you've used social styles there because you know that's one of the things I'm accredited in and that I do. So TRACON social styles, and lots of people have done like a DISC, a Myers-Briggs, like one of those personality questionnaire type things. And this is very similar, based on the same psychometrics and the same frameworks. And by the way, I am trained in that one, but I advocate for many of them because so much of this is about self-awareness. Now, we often go through life, and you know how some people are good. You say, oh, you're a great judge of character. You're really great at these things. What the frameworks of TRACON social styles or DISC or many of the others, what they do is they allow us to be able to, first off, understand ourselves. So very often we're not that self-aware, because we operate internally within ourselves. We only experience the world from within ourselves. We hear all our inner feelings, we understand those thoughts, but those things don't get out. And TRACON social styles helps us understand how others receive us. So how does Paul come across to Stephen? Now, I might think I'm coming across in a certain way, and you might go, yeah-ish, but actually, Paul, you can be more abrasive than you think you are, you can be more direct than you think you are, or actually you're really quite analytical sometimes, you go back into your shell and I don't see it, and I can't see it. So what the social styles framework does is allows us to understand ourselves and how others perceive us, and then how others also are, so their own styles, and how we can then take a bit of a gauge of other social styles And then how do we use that? How do we adapt ourselves? And it's one of the big things I love about the framework is that it has a versatility element of it. So the style you are is the style you are. That's it. Just no judgment. It is what you are. Versatility tells you how good you are at adapting to others. And if you're not great at it, how you can improve and how you can use that information that if Stephen's a certain style and Paul's a different style, how do we work best together? And again, it comes back to listening and empathy, saying, if I understand how Stephen wants to receive this information I'm trying to give, if I want to influence you to do something, heaven forbid, but if I were to want to influence you to do something like we often do in sales environments, in any relational type jobs, the best way to do it is by giving you information how you want it, not how I want to give that to you. So if I dial to stories, which you may be able to tell I do, but you don't, you dial to data. If I just go about telling you stories, you'll be like, oh, Paul, stop, please. However, I recognize that you want data, and I'm like, okay, I'll lead in with the data. This is the information that you need and how you need it. Then you're playing to the other person's needs, and you both get something out of it. And that's what I like about those frameworks, is if you use them well and effectively, then you can create relational capital by adapting, but not by compromising who you are, but by understanding how others are.
Given everyone is so different, is there, I don't want to say optimal number, but is there a number that we should be saying to our leaders, hey, that's too many to manage? Like, you do need to look after your team, grow your team, understand your team, and you can't do that if your team is too big.
That's a really good question. By the way, I'm not going to give you a definitive answer to that, because
I'm not expecting one, but you know where I'm coming from.
100%.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it is contextual, but yes. Now, for me, the thing that kind of defines the what's too many is the amount of time that you have to give to them. So if you're a leader who's got loads of demands in other places, and actually you can only commit, you've got 10 people in your team and you can only commit half an hour to them every 3 weeks, you've got too many people in your team. If you're a leader who actually has carved out time to actually manage folks, and you can give them all like one-to-one an hour every week, then you've probably got a bit of capacity. So it's contextual to the time that you give to others as to where that number is. But the time you give to them is the thing that defines whether or not you are instructing them to do a piece of work, or whether you're actually leading them to improve and get better and that kind of thing.
Right. Look, I love the phrase you use in your profile, being a tempered radical, which you describe as how to rock the boat without tipping anyone out. What does it mean to be a tempered radical in a corporate environment today?
Oh, I love it. It's a phrase that I like too, so thank you for hooking on to that. So I'm not going to... It is actually come from a book by Deborah Myerson, so I'm not going to claim it's my own. We always walk on the shoulders of giants. And being a tempered radical, there is space in every bit of life where we need change to happen for actual radicalism. So sometimes you need the people who are burning the building metaphorically. I'm not advocating for actually burning buildings, let's be very clear. Well, you need people that are willing to break some things, break some eggs to make the omelets, being the phrase. You need those. However, if everybody's doing that, then people can get frightened and upset and confronted. And the tempered radical and the whole kind of, you've got to be in the boat to be able to make the change. If you rock the boat so hard that you fall out or somebody else falls out, then no one's on that journey anymore. And for me, this is about changing the machine from within. So if you can understand and be able to say, hey, actually, I see there's a dysfunction over here. I see that this isn't right. I want to be part of the solution in a helpful way, in a contextually supportive way. One of the big dials of a good tempered radical is to call people in, not calling them out. And I'll explain that a little bit, because to call someone out is to say, Stephen, I saw you do this thing and I didn't like it, or it's wrong, or you should do that differently. Sometimes if someone is being really negative about something, then they need a bit of a short, sharp shock. To call someone in is to say, hey, Stephen, I saw you do this thing and help me understand why you did that, why you behaved and acted like that. Ah, okay, well, thanks for letting me know. It made me feel a bit uncomfortable, and I wonder if there's a different way that you could do that. Same context, same situation, but you're allowing for the dialogue, because naturally you call someone out, they'll get defensive. You call someone in, they may be open to listening to a different perspective, and good tempered radical will do that and help create the change instead of stopping the behavior.
If a manager is listening to our broadcast now and realises their team members perhaps don't feel accountable to each other, or, you know, what is one practical sort of actionable step that they could take tomorrow morning to start changing the culture of their team? Maybe they've got lots of people rocking those boats.
Well, and sometimes you do. Now, often you find that, obviously, leadership's a hard thing, by the way, and I'm at no point will I say that there is one answer to everything, but one of the things that a good leader will do is to set tone and purpose. So starting off with a lot of leaders and saying, why do we do this work? Understand the motivations of the people. Take a little step back and say, what does our team want to be known for collectively? And we can take, obviously, recognize this is Property Mappers webcast. So if you're in the industry and you're saying, what does this particular branch want to be known for? And it might be that we want to be the local heroes. We want to be the people who really support our community. So how does that show up? If you anchor to those things and everyone agrees on it and goes, yes, I mean, we're going to sell houses, but we're going to sell homes. We're going to make people feel like they're part of the community. How do you do that? That is beyond just the outcome of selling the house. Mm. That is about saying, hey, we've sold the house. And by the way, I hear you've got young kids. I'll introduce you to the local scouts or the local community or whatever it might be, and then you start enacting it and rewarding the behaviors that aren't the sales outcome or the productivity outcome. As a leader, you've set tone, you've given direction, you've created an environment where collectively you've all agreed, hey, this is how we want to show up, and then you've rewarded the behavior of them showing up. Because often we do the first thing, but not the second thing. Mm. Reward the behavior that you want to see, and people, guess what? We'll do it more.
Mm. Oh, we could talk for hours, but we've only got a couple of minutes left. So what is the New Zealand landscape looking like when it comes to leadership, when you compare it, I guess, to all the countries you've been in?
Well, interestingly, I think that Aotearoa has this weird mix of having some of the best leaders in the world. I mean, we've got many sports analogies that we could utilise for that. But actually, in business, there are smart, innovative people who recognise the need to think differently and embrace that difference. And in a small market, you can do that at a speed that in other countries you can't. And the connectedness of this market is quite incredible to create those spaces, which is why we're known for innovation. We are known for leading on a lot of things. The flip side is we're a tiny market. Mm. Everybody knows each other, and there can be some dysfunctions of nepotism, and there can be some dysfunctions of it's who you know, not what you know sometimes. So used in the right frame, we have got some incredible leaders that really are world-beating. And used in the wrong frame, it can be slightly different.
All right, you've got 45 seconds. How can people get in touch with you and involve you? And I guess in a nutshell, how can you get involved into a workplace?
Yeah, so, I mean, to get in touch with me, you can go to scantlebury-consulting.com. You can get me on LinkedIn. That's probably the easiest place, if I'm honest. Find me under Paul Scantlebury. And then invite the conversation. I'll happily talk to people about what their challenges are, how they're approaching those, and how I might be able to add value. And I'm only ever going to be in a conversation where there is mutual value to be added. So
reach out. That's nice. Reach out and start that conversation first to see how you can best engage with the situation.
Indeed, yes. So many things are tailored. Everything is personalised for me. I don't lift and shift exactly the same for everybody else.
Yeah, totally, totally. Paul, like I say, I don't think we got through even half of potential of where we could go, so we might have to get you back for round two to keep talking leadership. Absolute pleasure having you in here today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in on your Monday drive home. Take care, and we'll be back next week. We'll catch you again then on Property Matters.